I'm so glad you've taken time out of your day to join us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's all about you learning ways to keep more of what you have. Our websites, clark.com and clarkdeals.com. So we're in kind of a never-never land on coronavirus relief, as the $600 additional unemployment insurance expired in July, and a lot of people out of work are not in a position to pay their normal expenses. And so the economy has hit a slowdown again. It's why, for the first time in weeks, the Republicans and the Democrats are trying to reach a new stimulus package. And I think they will reach one. Don't know the size, what it will contain, but I think it's likely that they are going to cut a deal, just because neither party knows the consequences for them in November if they don't make a deal. But in the meantime, the president issued an executive order for a few weeks of time of additional unemployment, cutting the $600 to $300, and money that would be paid through the month of September. Well, so far, 40 of the 50 states, as of just a few hours ago, we're up to 40, have said that they want to participate, but only six have the things in place with their computer systems and their processes in order to be able to pay that money. So what will typically happen for people who've been unemployed during the period covered by the president's executive order is that people who were eligible but haven't received the money will likely receive it retroactively once your state is up and running to pay the additional $300. And this is just a Band-Aid on a problem of extremely high unemployment in the United States. And we're at somewhere around 10.5% stated unemployment. The real number, somewhere more like 16%. So that means we've got many tens of millions of Americans that are really, really hurting. And this is a hard, hard thing for people. There is a list available as to when states expect to maybe start paying the unemployment, but I've gone through the list and I don't even want to start stating from it because it's so wishy-washy. I think we're going to have to wait for people who are unemployed to be notified that it is available in your state. Now, the other thing that is underway today is employers will have an option of not collecting from you money temporarily for Social Security and Medicare to try to fatten up your check just a little bit. But it's only like a temporary loan to you. And unless there was a decision by Congress to take funding away from Social Security and Medicare, this money will have to be made up by you and me if your employer permits this, and the catch-up would start after the first of the year. So the idea of having a payroll tax holiday is to try to give people a little more money who are working, a little more money to spend, but it's only a temporary thing that rebounds with the money needing to be made up, because Social Security and Medicare are both very short of money. And if Congress did decide in its wisdom to not have this money have to be paid back September to December, that's a decision they can make. The problem with it is that it makes the deficits of Social Security and Medicare more severe and forwards the date when they will be short of money to pay recipients of Social Security and recipients of Medicare. And typically, the Congress doesn't want to mess with people's Social Security benefits or their Medicare benefits. So I imagine that this is not likely to become any kind of long-term thing where we won't pay in to fund Social Security and Medicare. And I want to explain that it's going to be confusing because employers don't have to allow this. Employers can continue to collect the Social Security and Medicare tax out of your paycheck and forward it on to the government as normal, or they can choose to not collect it, but it doesn't eliminate the obligation for that money. So this is a pretty messy thing, and I'm hoping that the Congress will come up with a deal that everybody can not necessarily be happy with, but everybody can agree to, and we move away from this hodgepodge of ad hoc kind of things, because I'm not a fan, you can probably tell by what I've said, I'm not a fan of the payroll tax relief on, and it's not really relief, it's just a delay on Social Security and Medicare, because I don't want anybody who is a recipient of Social Security or Medicare to worry that they're not going to get their money. And we've got to collect the money in order to pay to recipients of both programs. It's time for your questions for me, and you can post a question for me at clark.com/ask. Producers Kim and Joel alternate. And Kim, who do you start with today with a question?
Today we're starting with Tony from Florida. And Tony says, my daughter just got her first job out of college. She was hired as an independent contractor, making about $37,000 a year. I'm wondering if she should start an LLC and what's the best way for her to make estimated tax payments so she doesn't get hit with a big bill at the end of the year.
So unless the work she's doing creates a liability problem for her, because essentially she's operating as her own one-person company, working as an independent contractor, it's an unnecessary step for her at this particular stage of her life to set up a limited liability company, an LLC. Having said that, whether she was to set up an LLC or not, because no taxes are being withheld from her pay that she's getting as an independent contractor, she is supposed to make the estimated payments. What happens if she doesn't do them, and they're really easy to set up, if she doesn't make them, what happens is when she files taxes next year, she would owe a penalty for not paying in withholding on a timely basis. The penalty is not very friendly, but not very large right now, because interest rates that the IRS charges, because the interest rates prevailing in the economy, are pretty low. But all she has to do is go to irs.gov, in the search box, put in estimated payments, and they will walk her through how to do them. And it's a very, very simple process. Four times a year, you just mail in a check based on what you've been earning. You pay in the withholding that you think would have been withheld from a normal paying job where they withhold taxes. You just pay them in yourself. The one ugly thing for her is, I was just talking about Social Security and Medicare, she has to pay double tax. She has to pay both the employer portion and the employee portion. Approximately 15.3% will have to go into those programs. And that's the biggest unwelcome thing of all about being a self-employed individual. The other thing, though, is she has access to doing a SEP, a Simplified Employee Pension, which will directly reduce the overall tax bill she would have. It's a very flexible retirement account, takes nothing in terms of time to set up, and she's able to shelter a meaningful portion of her income each year if she can afford to do so. Joel?
Clark, Judy in California says, I'm happy that mortgage rates are so low now, and I'm considering refinancing before the December 1st fee increase. Our current mortgage on a rental home is 7%, and we have...
Whoa!
Right? It says we have $29,000 and 3 years left on that mortgage out of the original 30. I don't have any projects in mind to use the money from this from a cash out refinance, but the low rates seem too good to pass up. Would it make sense to invest the cash if I were to do a cash out refi on this property?
So I don't recommend any kind of refi in this circumstance with a balance of $29,000, even though you're paying a headline very high interest rate. There's not really a great way to go on it. But what you could do as an alternative, and ironically enough, I had a question a week or two ago that was somewhat similar to yours, where it made sense to do something I wouldn't normally recommend in this environment, but for you I would, and that is to take out a home equity line of credit if you can get approved for one on this property, pay off the $29,000 mortgage. You're going to pay it off in 3 years, and you will get a much lower interest rate on that HELOC, and the closing costs on a HELOC are extremely low. So that would be an alternative that you could consider. You may even be able to find a personal loan that would be lower than that mortgage rate that you could take out over 3 years and wipe out that balance at a lower interest rate than the 7%. But the worst that would happen is you just pay out the loan for three more years at that rate, which would be more cost effective and efficient than you doing any kind of cash out refi.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Joe joins us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Joe. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for taking my call, Clark. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So you are approaching retirement age, and at the same time, you're buying a house. Tell me about all that.
Yes, like next year, I'll be going to be 61 in a few months, and by 62, I like to retire. And I'm looking to buy a house, and houses are around $200,000, but I have three in my 401k, so I'm not sure like what percentage I should use for the house, knowing that I got to pay taxes on it because it's a 401 plan.
Yeah, you're subject to no penalty for using that money, but at the same time, you're creating a penalty of lack of flexibility. If you take a lot of that 401k money and put it towards the purchase of a home, because you can't eat your home. You know, if you kill off your available cash by piling it all in the house, you're creating risk for yourself later in your 60s or beyond that when you need money, you don't have access to money. So,
right. That's what. Yeah.
So do you own a home right now or are you a renter?
No, I'm renting right now, but I would be getting like a small pension too. It'd be like only $1,500 a month, but
only, let me tell you something. Most people listening to you would be thrilled to have $1,500 a month coming in from a pension. Are you going to take Social Security at age 62? Is that your plan?
Well, my plan is, to tell you the truth, I'm going to try and go month to month and see if I could do it without it. And then if I do need it, I will take it like that. I was just going to try it first, in other words.
But okay.
If I have to take it, I will.
And do you have savings to make a down payment on the $200,000 house?
Yeah, I have like a 10 in savings. I also have another 20 in a Roth.
Okay, I want you to leave the Roth money alone. The key would be to come up with $40,000 for a down payment so that you avoid private mortgage insurance on the mortgage.
Okay.
So if you have $300,000 in your 401k, I would take 40 of it out so you can drop the amount of the mortgage to 160. And do you know what the monthly mortgage payment would be approximately?
I'm looking at $1,100, $1,000, $1,200. It's like a $200,000 house, $210,000 house.
Okay. So if you're paying, you're paying basically what people pay for rent, you'd be paying in a mortgage. That's great. And will you have a big association fee or anything like that?
No, they're actually like only $30, $40 a month, the HOAs. And they've been like that for like 10, 20 years. So
excellent.
Nothing's going to shoot up. Yeah.
So I hate for you to have a mortgage going into retirement, but in
That's
your
what I mean,
case,
yeah.
the economics make sense. The $1,500 pension will go a long way for you in covering a lot of your living costs. And will you do any part-time work in your 60s?
I might, yes. I think just to keep busy, I will maybe, you know, a couple days a week.
I would say for more than keeping busy, I think it would be to your big financial advantage if you work some and had enough money with the pension and what you earn from working some to maybe even delay that Social Security, because every year you delay, your Social Security check's bigger and stays bigger throughout your retirement years. But I think that the one last thing I want to ask you that I've been just waiting to ask you is, how certain are you where this $200,000 property is where you want to live out your days?
Well, see, I want to be within 2 hours of my kids, and they're going to be in like an hour away. So I would say I'm going to probably end up there, really, because, you know, if I do some vacation place in Florida, but I think this would probably be the place.
Perfect. All right. So you're doing the right thing, and I'd take the 40K, as we talked about. That's all I'd use from the 401K. Money.
Okay.
And then carry that mortgage. It's not a terrible mortgage payment, and you should be good. And I hope you really, really love your life in retirement. But remember, I want you to be in semi-retirement, not full retirement, at least for a while in your 60s. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the Clark Howard Show, where it's all about you learning ways to save more and spend less. And don't let anyone ever rip you off. Our websites, Clark.com and ClarkDeals.com. So much automation is coming in our future. It's just amazing to think about the changes that are coming and the way we do things. And a lot of things are going to happen quicker than most of us expect because, you know, we're busy with our own lives and the way things are. But something that's gotten virtually no coverage at all is Amazon has received approval from the FAA to operate a fleet of Prime Air, what they call Prime Air delivery drones. These are non-line of sight drones. If you don't know what that means, historically the FAA has required that the use of drones be only within line of sight, meaning that the person operating that drone can see the full flight of that drone. What's so significant about what Amazon, UPS, and an operation called Wing, which is funded by the parent of Google, they have all received approval from the FAA for drone deliveries without line of sight. So someone in a control center or a package delivery center could load a package into the drone and it would fly off to its destination, deliver the package to you, and then fly back. And this is not some kind of sci-fi thing that's going to happen when our great grandkids are running around. This is something that you're going to see happen gradually at first and then rapidly. The idea is to be able to deliver things much, much, much faster than even what we have now, with an elimination of much of the labor cost. So do you know how long Amazon's been testing delivery drones? It's taken them 7 years to get it right. 7 years. But now they think it really is together. And the idea of the drones is they will not take a big, heavy package. The maximum weight of any package will be 5 pounds, although I'll tell you, if the drone malfunctioned and you got hit by a 5-pound package, that would not be pretty. And they'll be able to deliver in a 15-mile radius. So this is really a for-real thing. And Amazon expects to be delivering packages this way in what they say is just a few months. So they're not saying in 2020, but it's very, very likely that you're going to see this in 21. And there's all kinds of flying automation that's going to happen. I don't know if you saw, because it was in a foreign country, if you saw any of the media coverage of the Japanese flying car that is an electric flying car, and it's really kind of Jetsons-like, and it's not ready for prime time. Sorry for the Amazon reference. The Japanese flying car for people is not ready to transport people autonomously around Tokyo or whatever, but they're getting much closer. Now, if you go to more conventional air travel, just want to quickly update you. I've told you how United has followed Southwest's longtime policy and eliminated junk fees for changing your booking on most United fares. And since United did that, now Delta, American, and Alaska have done so. Still waiting to see what JetBlue is going to do. But the idea of charging people $200 to change a ticket they paid 138 round trip for is something that the public despises. And now the airlines have done away with it. United says they've done it permanently. I don't believe anything's permanent in the air travel business, but right now the airlines are hurting, trying to fill seats. And so they're all jumping on United's bandwagon with eliminating change fees. The one exception is if you buy an ultra-cheap economy basic ticket, that still remains non-changeable, non-refundable. It's time for your questions you posted for me at clark.com/ask. And Joel, I think it's your turn.
You would be wrong. It's
my turn. How many times in a row have I been right?
You have had a streak going, buddy.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kim.
Sorry you broke it.
I didn't mean to diss you.
All good. This is from Mark in Massachusetts. And Mark says, I have a deposit account with a large local savings bank. It has been announced that they are going public, which means that I have the opportunity to purchase stocks pre-IPO at about $10 a share. Over the years, I've heard some of my wealthier friends refer to an opportunity like this as a great windfall. They even open accounts at a wide variety of small mutual banks in hopes that something like this would happen. They call it Banco Bunco. I hope that I can buy the stocks cheap, and then in a few years, the IPO of the bank gets acquired by one of the big evil corporate megabanks, and then I make a killing. What do you think?
So it is a relatively low-risk purchase when a savings bank converts to stockholder-owned as to whether it's a way to get rich. It's not necessarily, and it's a tough environment right now for a bank going through an IPO, because conditions are not ideal right now with the interest rates being repressed in the economy and people having a tough time, maybe more likely to default on their debts. So this is not a slam dunk. I would not put money into a pre-IPO purchase of shares. That's money that you are going to absolutely depend on, but I think it's a worthwhile thing because you know the operation of this savings bank. You've been a customer of it. You know how they treat people. You like it. You've stayed there. So buying in is, although it's not a no-risk transaction, it's not a high-risk, it's a low-risk kind of thing. But again, not money that you'd lose sleep over if it didn't turn into a good number down the road. Joel?
Clark, Margot in Virginia says, we were given a timeshare at Hilton Head, South Carolina. It's time to get rid of it. Given, yeah.
Okay.
She says, we were already scammed by an exit company. We'll never see that money again. Now we're focusing on not losing more money through maintenance fees. We listed it for sale, for rent, and asked for a deed back. Nothing. Do I have any other options, Clark?
I wish I could tell you there was a way out, but unfortunately, timeshares are a defective industry because there are lots of sellers, no buyers. And so generally, you have to pay somebody to take over your timeshare obligation. And if you don't pay those fees, what happens is you can end up with a legal action against you at worst, and at best, generally, your credit will be heavily harmed. So as bitter a pill as it is to swallow, I encourage you, unless conditions change with the timeshare industry in the future, that you suck it up and pay those timeshare dues that you owe, and then use that week. Use your time there so that it's not just money down a rat hole. I wish I had a better answer for you, but the timeshare thing is an ugly, ugly story from the day you buy it till the day you find out you can't sell it and beyond. Kim?
May in Minnesota says, I leased a car and now I love it. Gets over 50 miles a gallon. It's very comfortable and we travel a lot. I know I will be buying this car at the end of the lease, but I'm wondering, should I see if I can buy it now or should I wait for the 3 years till the lease ends?
And it's generally a case that you want to wait till the end of the 3 years, but especially with the distortions going on right now in the used vehicle marketplace, you want to wait because any deal that you would have in the contract language of the lease or that you would attempt to negotiate would be inferior to just waiting out the 3 years. And right now you love it, love it, love it. Let the full clock run. See if you still feel just as strongly 3 years into the lease and then buy it either under the terms of the lease or if the residual in the lease is too high, you'll then have a choice you're going to need to make. You approach the company that has the lease. Hopefully it's a bank and not one of the manufacturers. See if you can negotiate a reduced residual buyout because if the residual is too high, you're overpaying for the vehicle. Or you may find if the residual is too high, you walk away. If the residual is good, stated in the lease, just know you know the history of the vehicle and pay them the money that the residual calls for. Joel?
Clark, Jake in Wisconsin says, one of the large cell phone carriers offers $10 off per month per line if you enroll in their auto pay program. So, for example, you get in a three-line plan $30 off a month. When enrolling in AutoPay, you must use a debit card or checking account to receive the discount. Credit cards are not accepted. So my question is, are the potential savings if you're enrolling in an AutoPay program worth the potential risk of your checking account or debit card being compromised since they don't have the same safeguards that credit cards have?
I would say that in this case, it's worth it. When you're saving that much money a month, the potential risk of a compromise of your account is worth it because of the amount of money over the course of a year, you'd save $360. That is worth the chance you'd be taking. Now, there is an alternative that people do, and that is they'll set up an account with an online bank. You know, there's no minimums, no fees, and set that up with some money in it for the auto debit each month. And that way, the only money that's at risk is the money that you would have placed in there specifically to pay this cell phone auto debit, and then you would have close as you could to zero risk if something were to go wrong with the account being hacked. Or another case is when, after you're done with that cell phone company, they keep accidentally debiting you anyway. Francesca is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great, Clark. How are you?
Great, thank you. So you have been a diligent saver for your future for a long time, and you're in a position where now you've got what seems like too much of a good thing, too many different accounts rolling around your life. Is that right?
Yes, and it's too much to track effectively, much less know if we're reasonably diversified. We've got his and hers of everything, it seems like, and ours.
Wow. What kind of accounts do you have? Let me make a list as you talk.
Okay, well, we each have Roths. We each have traditional, and somehow my husband has a second traditional IRA. We have rollover IRAs. He has a 401k that's still at a former company. He has an active 403b because he's an adjunct professor. And we have investments also. Some are in his name and some are in our names.
Okay. So as far as duplication, what we've got here is we've got one 401k that he's got, but you don't have any 401ks. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. And then the 403Bs got from the side job. And then the rollover IRA, let's talk about that. That came from former jobs 401k?
Correct.
Okay, so there's a couple of options with that. Let's talk about downsizing numbers of accounts right here. So the rollover IRA could potentially go into the 401k that he has. Is that from a current job or former job?
Former.
Former. Okay, so that's not going to work. What about taking the 401k money, the rollover IRA money, and hopefully one of the traditionals that he has, because you say he had two traditional IRAs?
Yes.
That one of those is with a low-cost company, please tell me?
I'm 90% certain it's with Fidelity.
Okay. So if he was able, if he took the old 401k, the rollover IRA, and that other traditional IRA, and merged all of those into the one traditional at Fidelity, that would reduce the clutter you have in your life a lot.
Okay.
The only flexibility he'd give up is that rollover IRA could, at some point in the future, go into a future employer's 401k plan. But really, this is just, you're right. There's too many statements, too many accounts, and give up that one bit of flexibility by getting all those together into that one traditional IRA. And you eliminate one, two, three accounts just right there.
Okay.
All right. Now, let's talk about the, okay, so you have a traditional, he has two, go down to one. So one each, that's okay. You each have your own Roth IRA, that's okay. So we eliminate that. All right, so the last thing, the investment accounts. So you've got one that he's got just with investments he owns, and then there's one that you own together, but you don't have your own investment account. Is that right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And we have two that have both of our names on them.
So you have two at two different firms?
Yes.
All right. So that would be a case that whichever firm is the lower cost firm, that you eliminate one of those, move the holdings in it over to the other firm.
Okay.
There, if you can just move holdings over, there's no tax consequences. You'd eliminate another account.
Okay.
And I know this is all a bit overwhelming, but better that you be overwhelmed by having all these accounts, which means you've been saving all this money and investing all this money, than have none or just a few.
Yes, we understand. We've been blessed that way.
But definitely cleaning this up would be a big help to you for planning going forward. And within the retirement accounts, there's no tax implication at all of moving the money like I've described. And the if it is Fidelity, you can go into Fidelity with all the statements you've got from all these stray accounts, and Fidelity will do the paperwork for you that you just have to sign and will handle moving the money from all those into the one Fidelity traditional IRA that your husband would keep. And you'd clean up a lot of the hassle you've got right now. You're listening to the Clark Howard Show. Thanks for joining us today. The Clark Howard Show is produced by Kim Drobes, Joel Larsgaard, Deborah Reese, and Jim Ayers. And remember, 24 hours a day, we're there to serve you at Clark.com and ClarkDeals.com.